Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, fans of good books and good writing. Welcome back to New Books in Science Fiction. I'm Rob Wolf, and today is our More Fun Than a Barrel of Monkeys edition. With me today is an author who, after writing several well-received books, nearly gave up writing entirely. Fortunately, she decided to give it one more shot, and just last month, that effort earned her the Philip K. Dick Award, which is given each year for the best science fiction novel published as an original paperback. The book I'm talking about is The Theory of Bastards, and its author is the person you just heard, and her name is Audrey Shulman, and she's with me on the line from her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for coming on New Books in Science Fiction.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. It's very, very kind. I'm excited to be here.
Well, congratulations on winning the Philip K. Dick Award. I know you were so surprised that you won that you didn't even have a speech prepared.
Yeah, I felt really bad for not thinking that, not preparing anyway. But I never win anything. I don't even win like bingo. So it totally took me by surprise.
Before we dive into the book, I'm curious to know why you almost quit writing. You even mentioned that in the acknowledgments of The Theory of Bastards. So I wonder why you almost quit and what brought you back.
So I've had a hard time getting published at certain points, a lot. I feel like I've had a harder time getting published than many other writers. And maybe that's what every writer feels, but let me just give you details so you can judge on your own. I started writing when I was 20, and I wrote a book a year, every year for a decade. And I couldn't get any of them published. And it wasn't until the 10th book that I think my 5th book was picked up to be published. And that was called The Cage. It got translated into, I think, 11 languages. And the New Yorker did a review, and I got like 100 other reviews. It was just an incredible reception. And then when I sent, a year later in the novel that I wanted to get published next to the publisher that had published The Cage, they said no. They didn't like the book, and they didn't even like the font. They were fairly strong about the way they said it. And that happened again with, it just seemed like I had a really hard time getting the books published. But once they were published, they always got great receptions. So maybe every writer feels this way. I don't know.
I've heard often people having stories that are variations on the same theme, although I guess some stories are more extreme than others. But people who, whose books are well received, I have heard of them having trouble getting published again, maybe because being well received doesn't always translate into a lot of sales, and a lot of publishers care about money as the bottom line.
I've always been told, I don't know if this is true, but that the publishing industry before, earlier than, say, the 80s, it was about publishing works that the publisher thought were really high quality and not so much about dollars per inch of bookshelf. So it might be that having publishing companies be owned by bigger and bigger companies have moved it more into a monetary equation, which isn't necessarily a horrible thing, but I feel like we miss a lot of the long tail distribution or the diversity of thought that could be out there. And I believe democracy depends partly on having a really well-educated and thoughtful population. And so I, for many different reasons, I think that there should be as great a diversity of books out there as possible.
Well, your story, I think, is inspiring in that you didn't give up and you decided to keep on trying. And so what, in fact, brought you back, made you decide, after having had these experiences, to write another book?
My editor at Europa decided to publish my book just before Theory of Bastards, which was called 3 Weeks in December. And with him wanting to publish another book, I thought this was worth it. I mean, I've always wanted to write. There's nothing more I've wanted. And so given the opportunity, I couldn't say no. In the case of Theory of Bastards, it was such a fun book to write, too.
Well, let's get into it then, and let's talk about why it was such a fun book to write. Maybe we should lay out a little bit of the story. The Theory of Bastards touches on a lot of themes and has several plot lines. It's about bonobos, which are among, or maybe they are humans' closest relatives in the animal kingdom. And there's a storyline about technology and our growing reliance on it, or our maybe even our over-reliance on it. And the book also touches on climate change and sexuality. And maybe at its core, it's about the relationship and the past histories of your main characters, who are two scientists, Frankie Burke and David Stott, who are actually studying the bonobos. Maybe we should start with the bonobos.
You know, what I find amazing is that many people don't know about them. They look basically like chimpanzees, except for they're a little skinnier and less muscular. Their hair tends to be parted in the middle as though they just parted it with a comb and sort of slicked down a little bit like alfalfa in The Little Rascals. And they are just the sweetest, most gentle creatures. You know, we all grew up with stories of like the violence of chimpanzees that will, with determination, go, you know, premeditated, go out and hunt and kill another chimp in groups. So the story is always of this humans being related to this, you know, our closest relation being this violent, angry great ape. But in fact, some scientists believe that bonobos are even more closely related, or at least more like what is considered the missing link in terms of both the brain. They have von Economo neurons, otherwise known as spindle cell neurons. They're the kinds that are associated with empathy and self-recognition and humor and kindness. And they're also just in terms of their body shape, the limb to torso ratio, et cetera. They look a little bit like what Lucy would have looked like, the earliest human relation.
They seem in many ways more civilized than humans. I mean, more peaceful, more cooperative, more loving. That's almost like a message coming from the book that's never explicitly stated, but they are so wonderful. And to tell you the truth, after becoming so fond of them from your book, I just Googled and read that they're actually endangered in the wild. And I thought it was strange that given that they're so closely related to us, there isn't a hue and cry about their decline.
Well, so most people don't know about them, and that's partly because they're overtly sexual. So their way of reducing aggression and violence is through having sex. They'll have it, you know, if under any tension. And so zoos won't have bonobos very often. There are a few that do, but not many do, because the parents don't won't know what to do with the kids if the bonobos are constantly having sex in the zoo enclosure. And, you know, PBS won't do a lot of specials on them because they'd have to edit it so much. So we don't know a lot about bonobos, and therefore we don't understand that they are endangered, which is just terrible.
It's incredible that our prudishness would interfere with our interest and efforts to protect this very special species.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just doing research on them just made me happy because they're just so sweet and gentle. Like in all the research I did, the only case in which I found any bonobo attacking another one was just one bonobo bit another one and broke the skin slightly. So a teeny bit of blood came out. And everybody, you know, all the other bonobos were so horrified, they kept coming over and examining the hand as though this had never happened before, which is just remarkable. Franz de Waal is one of the major researchers of them, of bonobos, and he just writes beautiful stories about the different episodes he's seen with them, where they care for one another or just how smart they are and kind.
Did your research consist mainly of books? You have a research appendix at the end of the novel, so it's clear that a lot of the stories and the scenes of the way the bonobos relate to each other are actually based on real-life observations of scientists. I just wondered if you had any firsthand encounters with bonobos.
No, I tend to, you know, different people learn in different ways. And I learn really well from reading. And so I just tend to read book after book after book until it seems real to me. And so what I did in this book was take a lot of stories from the researchers and weave it together into one narrative. So there's a point at which, for instance, one of the bonobos comes upon a bird that had hit some glass and fallen on the ground. And so the bonobo looked at the bird for a while and sort of, you know, which seemed to be unconscious, and opened its wings and touched it very gently, trying to figure out what was wrong, and then picked it up and climbed to the top of a climbing structure and threw the bird back into the air, and then seemed really baffled when the bird didn't begin to fly because it was either unconscious or dead. If you think about that, the bonobo understood the bird needed help and was trying to return it to its element, which is such an interesting image and story. But there are a lot of them, of stories like that, where there's a classic bit of research where you have basically a tray of food on wheels with a rope around it, so that in order to pull it towards you, the rope is not tethered to the tray in any way. Two different animals have to pull it toward them together at the same time, cooperate. And when this research is done with chimpanzees, it takes them a long time to understand what they need to do. And then as soon as the tray of food is pulled close enough, they start fighting to grab the most amount of food. Whereas bonobos will understand really quickly and will never fight over the food once they get it close enough. They're just kind creatures, and it comes through so much in the research.
Well, one of the beautiful things about your book, I think, is that we see the bonobos through one of the scientists' eyes. Well, maybe both their eyes, but the main character is Frankie Burke, and she's discovering them as we're discovering them. And you've really layered some of the stories that you've described just now. As she's discovering them, we're discovering them. And it feels like a real building of knowledge. And in her case, she actually has a thesis she wants to prove. And that thesis is, in fact, the title of your book. It's The Theory of Bastards. And I wondered if you could explain, what is the theory of bastards?
So first off, I was so excited with the title because this way I get to swear a lot in public. But the basic idea of the theory of bastards is some research has shown that approximately 10% of children, human children, are not actually related to their fathers. So, and I'm not sure, there is some research that, I'll just qualify this slightly, that number is less than I'm saying, but I'm not, when I wrote the book, it was 10%. So, you know, you have to wonder why there is such a huge percentage of children that are not related to their fathers. What is the evolutionary benefit of that? because there has to be a big benefit to be able to do that, because the dangers are so big for getting pregnant illegitimately, I guess, for having a bastard. And so the theory that my character comes up with, Frankie Burke, is that it offers genetic benefits. The basic idea is that the fathers being selected by the mothers are being selected because they will improve the child's immune function. So she comes up with a theory about why such a large percentage of human children are created through affairs, basically. And it gets her a lot of renown because it's a fairly unusual theory.
And is it a theory that you invented on Frankie's behalf, or is it something that has in fact been researched at one time or another?
I think I wove it together. I mean, the thing about writing is that, at least my experience of writing, is it's a little bit like driving in a car during a car accident, right? You have just images left over afterwards, and you have to sort of piece them together to try to figure out how it all happened. So I'll give you what I think happened. I think I did an enormous amount of research, and I came up with the theory on my own. And it was just making logical assumptions based on all the research I did about sexual attraction and immune function. There's some really interesting research about how one researcher had men sleep in T-shirts, and then took those T-shirts and put them in cardboard boxes and had women smell the T-shirts through the holes in the cardboard box, so that the women don't even know what they're smelling, right? And they would be choosing, they would say, this smells good, or that one does not. And the T-shirts that they would select would be of men who had a different immune function than they did. So what we tend to do is we select people who have a different immune function so that our children will have stronger, more robust immune functions than we do. Because viruses and parasites will evolve way faster than we long-lived humans can. So it's critical for the health of our children to have a really strong, healthy immune function. So I just made assumptions based upon that. And that's how I came up with the theory, or I believe I came up with the theory.
And I guess in Frankie's mind, the bonobos, because they are freewheeling as far as sex is concerned, are sort of expressing perhaps this urge, the female's urge or intuition or programmed desire, programmed by their DNA desire to find the best match as far as the immune system is concerned. So it's they're the purest form of that, whereas humans, presumably, because of our cultural restrictions, laws, customs, mores, even if a woman perhaps feels a desire to be infidelitous, in an individual case may repress that, although not always, obviously, if that 10% number or anything even like it is true. Obviously, people do go outside the bounds of monogamy, if that's what the culture they're in, if asks for monogamy or so-called requires it. But is that the idea?
But I think it's slightly different, that I think humans pretend that we are different, but we are not. What's really fascinating to me is humans are the only animal that I know of that goes off to have sex in private, right? That feels that it's a function that others should not see. And part of the reason, I think, is because there's a lot of secrets that go on there. Right. So it enables infidelity in many ways. And I think that instinct, or this would be my gut feeling, is that instinct that humans have of like, this is something done in private, is partly to enable all sorts of stuff to happen that wouldn't be considered kosher. I mean, in terms of infidelity in the wider human society. And what's interesting with the bonobos is they don't have that, right? They'll have sex in front of you, in front of their entire bonobo clan. And this was fictional. This I do not think, you know, I've never read any research that says this about bonobos. My theory is about bonobos, because I'm going to back up for a minute. They have sex with intercourse with anyone, anytime, anywhere, right? And you can't have that if you have evolution also, because then there's the, if the females are getting, are having sex when they are fertile with anyone, they will quickly end up with a six-toed, they'll end up with all sorts of bad evolutionary results, right? They'll be cousins having, you know, offspring together. It will be bad news. No one will be selecting the most fit mate possible for their offspring. So my theory with the bonobos is that when the females are fertile, I'm betting, and it'll be really interesting if any researcher ever contacts me and tells me if this is true, that they do, that they are secretive at that point, that they head off with the male that they do think would be the best ideal father for their offspring. Because otherwise, I doubt bonobos would be so smart or able to even stand up straight, because evolutionarily, they wouldn't be fit, if that makes sense.
So that's in the book what in fact happens. So Frankie begins to see what she thinks is this behavior. So that's interesting to hear that that's where you depart from bonobo behavior as it's represented in all the books you have in the appendix.
Yes. I just assume they can't possibly be not selecting well for genetic material at the point that the females are fertile, because if so, they'd be unevolving back down to amoebas or something.
On your website, you have a Q&A section, and you tell a story that basically explains that you have a personal connection to this idea, that this idea has emerged from your personal life experience. And I was hoping you could elaborate a little on that right now and explain what that personal connection is.
So my parents were divorced partly because my mom was unfaithful. And so that's always made me think about fidelity and made me sort of wonder on it. And our human obsession, female fidelity, always seems just interesting to me. That part of the book is about Frankie, the character, spends a lot of time like looking at movies about unfaithfulness or trying to find them. And she can't, because there aren't all that many. There are TV channels that are just devoted to the Civil War, right? They're just show after show after show after show. But if you're looking for movies about what should be an incredible story, I mean, it's got love, it's got automatic tension, right? If you have infidelity, there aren't that many. And I think that's partly because a lot of directors are male and just are in, don't want to talk about that subject. Or anyway, that was yet another of my theories, which I have just so much fun in the book developing. But the book's not all about theories. It sounds that it's a science book or something. It's not. I've always enjoyed books where I learn something and at the same time, I'm deeply engaged in the plot and the characters. That for me is an ideal book where the writer is not talking down to me, but is instead giving me all sorts of interesting chunks of information that I can chew on and digest as I am utterly pulled forward by both the plot and deeply worried about the character. That's my kind of book. And I hope that that's what this book is.
You know, it's definitely that kind of book. So now is a great time to segue to talk a little bit more about, I think, Frankie and who she is. She's someone who in many ways seems to have withdrawn from the world due to various reasons, having suffered both, I think, in some personal relationships with men, but primarily having suffered a lot of pain because she had or has endometriosis. And by the time we meet her, it's almost as if she's given up on human relationships. And it seems as if as she becomes more and more connected to the bonobos, it helps her return to humanity because she seems to become more and more drawn to her colleague at the foundation as well, David Stotz.
Yeah, I thought it was, Frankie is an evolutionary psychologist, and I thought it would be really fun to have somebody who is really interested in evolution be unable to reproduce, because there's an interesting irony there. And then also, for me, the book is all about what it's like to be in a body and how being in a body affects you. So the bonobos are in one kind of body, and Frankie's in another kind, and David Stotz is in another kind, and each, the strengths, the weaknesses of each is sort of played out through the book.
It's interesting because Frankie has recently had surgery, has had hysterectomy, actually. Mm-hmm. And so when the book opens, she's quite debilitated from that surgery. And over time, she grows more and more strong. And then the plot takes a sharp turn. So it's a good thing, in fact, that she's more physically able to get around, because she really needs to. And I guess in a way it's a bit of a spoiler, but it's hard not to talk about the book without addressing what happens in the second half somewhat. And that really is more about, in some ways at least, the setting is about technology. Because the book is set in the near future, there's all these technical, techie, whiz-bang things that people benefit from. And one of them is these implants that everyone seems to have, and that feeds data to lenses in their eyes. And everyone just kind of assumes that that'll always be there. And they rely on them kind of the way we rely on phones. That's what I was thinking, that they basically have lots of apps that just play right in front of their eyes. And then something happens halfway through the book. There's a dust storm, and it seems to zap everything. And Frankie and Stotz are left behind to take care of the bonobos during the dust storm, and they become increasingly desperate. I mean, the plot really becomes almost an adventure story, because it's like, how are they going to survive without maybe food in this place where everything, all the technology that they've come to depend on has completely failed? And it's almost like two books in one. And I wonder if there's something you could say about that, about your decision to take that sharp left turn.
I mean, I love books that have a killer plot, like where all sorts of things happen, and where I'm deeply drawn in and can't stop reading. But I also love smart books. So a lot of my books start off where it's, you're just getting used to the character and the ideas, and then they go strong into the plot, which at that point should be the vehicle for those ideas in a way. But for me, where this book came from was, or partly, was like, I was once at a Whole Foods, and there was, I think it was the same day, there was a guy in like aisle number 4 looking at all the cereals, clearly unable to find anything to eat. And I think the same day I bumped into somebody, or somebody asked me for directions, and he was holding an iPhone in his hand with Google Maps on it. I find us so, as a species, we are deeply capable, right? We're capable of making iPhones and Google Maps, but we aren't capable of finding food in aisle number 4 or in migrating across town, much less thousands of miles away. I find us just a species with these incredible strengths and incredible weaknesses. And I wanted to explore that in this novel. And I've always loved dystopian novels, post-apocalyptic ones, right? But it's almost always only able-bodied humans that survive. Nobody ever pulls their pet corgi out of the rubble and marches on. And I just thought it would be really interesting to sort of play out what would happen if a relatively capable, somewhat similar to humans, species survived with humans post-apocalypse, or something there, something similar to an apocalypse, and what that would be like. And that was my dog scratching at the door. I'm going to let her in hopes that she gets a little quieter.
Wow. when they leave the foundation with the bonobos in tow, Frankie and Stotts survive by breaking into homes and eating prepackaged food.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the bonobos, I mean, they can run around and find food. When they go into a field, they start digging up potatoes. Like, they have a much more natural and intuitive method of surviving, it seems. Although, you know, you raise a big question, and who will be able to survive better, the bonobos or the humans?
Yeah, and I just thought that that was a really interesting question to begin to look at. I feel like we are, you know, the term superorganism? It's, you know, like bees, you know, honey hive, a beehive is a superorganism where any one bee on its own, even though it's in a separate body, could not survive on its own, you know, away from the hive. And I feel like humans are somewhat of a superorganism, right? That on our own, out in the wilderness, we don't tend to survive very well, that we need society as a whole functioning as one organism to enable us to do well. Whereas I think bonobos and other great apes are not that way as much. And I just wanted to play with that concept. I also wanted to play with the idea that Frankie, in some way through the book, regains her humanity by being around the bonobos, by being around non-humans. And she's able to feel more, to care more for others, to become more healthy by just learning to care about the bonobos. So I played with all sorts of things throughout the book in a way that was great fun for me.
And I think the last thing I thought would be interesting to touch on is to talk a little bit about climate change, because I understand that you co-founded an organization that tries to reduce the leakage of natural gas. I'm probably going to get this wrong, but the leakage of natural gas into the environment, which seems to me connected to climate change. And I wondered how that work connects with themes in your writing.
You know, I think climate change is the biggest threat to humans and other life on this planet. It's the biggest moral question facing humanity. It's the biggest practical question. And I can't understand why more writers aren't, I mean, I know that there's a lot of climate fiction beginning to be out there, but it seems remarkably little for the incredible plot that is just clear about climate change. You know, we've never had anything, you know, such an existential, huge, species-wide threat as climate change, and even multicellular threat as climate change. I've always wanted to write about it in more depth, and I got to with this book. It's just a great plot, right? You know, the climate starts to go wacky, all sorts of things are going to happen. I don't know if you can hear my dog jumping around in the background, but...
Well, not too much, but I suppose your dog cares about climate change as much as you do.
Absolutely. But ever since my eldest child was born, who was born in the year 2000, just made all the scientific predictions of climate change so deeply personal, because they're in, you know, 2030 when he turns 30, or 2050 when he's 50. And so because of that, I just care, beyond the fact that I'm awfully fond of this planet. And most of my friends are multicellular.
And as nice as the bonobos, I hope.
I only wish they were.
So has the Philip K. Dick Award encouraged you now? Are you going to keep writing? Are you working on something else?
Yeah, I'm working on a new novel about dolphins. So I seem to be very, I feel like every writer, if they're very lucky, they figure out the themes that allow them to do their best writing. And I seem to have very, very narrow themes. So if it's got some large charismatic megafauna, a hint of possible violence, you know, a different climate, and some possible scientific research, and the main character has to be in a body that's somehow physically different from most other people. Those are sort of the themes that allow me to write as well as I possibly can. So this book has almost all of that in it.
Well, that sounds great, and I can't wait to read it. I hope the publishers are clamoring for it when it's done.
That would be nice. Maybe every writer has hard a time. I certainly think it's a hard time for anybody to get published.
Well, you know, I hear lots of stories. I myself am going through it as well, and it always sounds like everything is a hurdle. There's never coasting unless you're that 1% of best-selling author who's books, you know, generate millions. Everyone wants to publish them. But getting an agent takes forever if you're lucky to ever get one. And then the agent can take forever to find the publisher, and that can take forever. And then it gets out. And then, you know, selling, actually getting the book sold can take forever. So there's no guarantees in life and in writing.
Yeah. Before getting published, I always thought that once I got published, everything would change. You know, after that, it would be simple. And so it was surprising to me when it just sort of continues. It's still hard. But I feel very, very lucky to be able to write and to get published, at least for the books that I have so far.
Well, thank you so much for your writing and for coming on New Books in Science Fiction.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on it.
I've been talking to Audrey Shulman, the author of The Theory of Bastards, which just won the Philip K. Dick Award. If you don't subscribe yet to New Books in Science Fiction, I invite you to sign up using your favorite podcast app. That way you won't ever miss an episode, and please consider leaving a review. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com. The editor-in-chief and founder of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe, and the editor is Leanne Wilson. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe. I'm at robwolf.net and on Twitter at robwolfbooks. Thank you for hanging out with us today.